This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The Bible is pretty clear. Hospitality is every believer's responsibility. One verse says you may be helping an angel when you help a stranger. Jesus said, "That which you do for the least of these, you do also to me." So it's easy to see why some faith organizations feel compelled to render humanitarian aid along the southern border. Customs and Border Protection often delivers migrants to faith-based shelters directly from detention centers. Volunteers provide food, shelter, clothing, and travel assistance, often in official partnerships with government agencies at all levels. But the cost of this help is not just financial. It's creating political fault lines within liberal and conservative churches, including among white evangelical voters who helped elect Donald Trump president. Some say that their churches are enabling illegal immigration and that aiding migrants is inherently political. Others say this is a strictly moral issue, nothing to do with politics, but it's making people of faith pay for the administration's failings. As part of our Project 1A Across America, we tagged along with volunteers from an Episcopal church in Houston as they headed to McAllen, Texas, a few miles from the border. What role are these religious organizations playing at the border? How do these congregations view immigration? How do they deal with conflicting views on what their church should do? And what could all this mean for next year's election?
Our car is packed with our personal belongings, but we are really looking forward to this trip. We were saddened to see the picture on the news yesterday of the man and his 24-month-old child who drowned.
It's late June. Michael Jacobs is loading his blue Subaru SUV. He's a retired lawyer in Houston. He and his wife Melissa are making their second trip to McAllen in 2 months. They're already planning a third and a fourth. Melissa is Episcopalian. Michael is Jewish, but he attends her church.
And we have a travel mezuzah.
They'll make the trip with Father Simon Bautista, canon for Latino ministries at Houston's Christ Church Cathedral.
I just call Simone Simone. I think he's comfortable with that.
I'm okay.
Okay. We just call Simone Simone.
Okay.
They're going to volunteer at a Catholic-run respite center in McAllen. It's a sanctuary for migrants who've recently been released from detention centers. It offers food, clothing, shelter, and access to a nationwide network of help. This trip is also a fact-finding mission. When they're back in Houston, they plan to recruit volunteers and share what they saw at the border. Melissa and Michael deny any political motivations, but Melissa concedes that they're getting harder to deny. She says her conservative friends have told her not to help migrants because they're taking advantage of our asylum policy.
They don't agree with the policies, so they see that our support is an endorsement of the an endorsement of what they don't support. And my thought is that you cannot physically be in the presence of these women and children and these people and have your heart be that hard.
Father Simon immigrated from the Dominican Republic and recently became a citizen. He says his longstanding interpretation of Scripture shows that God wants believers to welcome migrants. But lately, more people are viewing that interpretation as political.
I mean, the political atmosphere somewhat is bringing people to a kind of black or white color. And things are just, you know, seen and perceived through the glance of that. So I believe that we got ourselves in a very, very dangerous place where a conversation cannot happen. And you got to be careful what you say, politically speaking.
Michael says all four of his Jewish grandparents immigrated to the U.S. in the early 1900s. They faced resistance similar to what Central American migrants face now. He says he feels a duty to be there for them.
Their first exposure is the welcoming arms
by the volunteers. And I can imagine what it would be like for my grandparents to come over. Be welcome.
The drive from Houston to McAllen is 350 miles. It's nearly a 7-hour trip. Along the way, oak trees turn to palms. Dirt turns to sand. The air gets humid as the Midwestern climate turns tropical. When they arrive, the volunteers go to the transit station in downtown McAllen to meet migrants arriving from detention centers. Hundreds of migrants arrive here each day by bus, dazed, tired, disoriented, silent. Luis Guerrero is a full-time volunteer who tracks how many people arrive at the bus station each day.
46, and they brought them from here from McAllen. We always write down how many buses came in. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 buses already.
Inside the station, Michael is buying all the kids a soda.
Coca-Cola again. It's like bingo. Like Donata. Donata.
Father Simon speaks with migrants. One migrant, who we'll call Raul for safety reasons, is from Honduras.
So they left Honduras because, first of all, the country is very unstable now. The economy is very bad. There's no employment. There is a lot of insecurity on the streets, violence, gangs, and so on. So they feel that they feel insecure.
Raul came to the U.S. with his wife and two children from the Honduran town of Juticalpa. He says he was separated from them for 8 days while he was in detention.
Es muy duro estar ahí. Lo tratan muy mal.
It is very hard to be there. They humiliate us. They speak bad to us. Only for very brief, they will let them lie down on mattresses, small mattresses. But then during the night, they cannot use them and they have to sleep on bare floor.
Estar encerrado en ese centro de detención de migración.
So for him, the worst part of the journey was to be, you know, like in this kind of cluster, and close in the center of detention.
His story is common among those who spoke to us. Detention stays tend to last around 8 days. Men are separated from their families. Kids stay with their mothers. Maybe they'll shower infrequently. Rarely do they get to brush their teeth. Sick children are quarantined, but not treated.
Me hizo sentir muy mal a todos mis amigos de todo Centroamérica.
So he would like to specifically to send this message to his countrymen in Honduras, but also to his friends in Central America. If they have not yet left their country, to think it twice, because the way that he's being treated at the detention center, he believes that shouldn't be part of the suffering. He says that the suffering is not taking the road, or leaving the country, and you know, making the journey. Suffering starts when he gets and when they got to the detention center, because they treated them there very badly and inhumanely.
Good morning. It's Thursday the 27th, 8:06. It's a little fitful night with anxiety about what we're going to see today.
It's day two, and the volunteers are heading to the respite center. You can tell the center used to be a nightclub. It's cool and dark with black walls and a bar in the corner. But instead of liquor bottles, the shelves have aspirin, tampons, and shaving cream. Adults stand silently in line for clothes and for food. Children run around, draw, kick tennis balls to each other, and hug stuffed animals. 1A's James Morrison asks one group of girls how old they are.
¿Cuántos años tienes?
Ocho.
Seis.
Melissa holds the hand of a 7-year-old girl who will not leave her side.
The children are the most emotional part. You would have to be granite to not respond to these children.
Michael helps a crying child find new shoes to replace his dirty, worn-out pair.
So, what can we do for you? We'll get you some shoes? Would you like some shoes, zapatas?
Melissa's childhood friend, Trish Williams, is among the volunteers. She attends a Catholic church back home in Mobile, Alabama.
I was talking to one of my best friends there, and I told her what we were doing, because I was getting donations from people, and she said, yes, but do we really want all those thousands and thousands of people? And she's one of the most beautiful Christians I know. And I looked her in the eye and I said, this isn't about politics. This is not what we're talking about here. These are human beings that need help. And it's not about politics. And that's all I can say to people.
Sister Norma Pimentel runs the respite center in downtown McAllen. She started it at a nearby church in 2014 as unaccompanied minors began reaching the border in record numbers.
We thought it was just going to be for a couple of days. Turned out that this was ongoing. It never stopped.
Sister Norma says more migrants come through this location than any other respite center in the country, upwards of 900 people a day. She does not hide her disdain for the current immigration policies, like limiting the number of asylum seekers who can enter the U.S. each day. She blames this policy for the death of Oscar Ramirez and his 23-month-old daughter. The nation cringed at a photo of them face down along the Rio Grande, the border between the U.S. and Mexico. They drowned while trying to cross, just a few days before our visit.
This family was trying to enter our country the right way through the points of entry, and they waited for weeks and months because the policies that we have in place deters them from doing that and keeps them desperate to the point that they risk their lives and going through a river that was dangerous and losing their lives because of that. We have to hold our leaders accountable.
Coming up, we'll continue our journey along the southern border. We'll hear why a high-tech smart wall might not work and how Mexican cartels are capitalizing on the influx of migrants. This reporting is part of our special project 1A Across America, a collaboration with six stations, including Houston Public Media. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Today we're hearing from church volunteers who traveled from Houston to the southern border. It's part of our reporting project 1A Across America, a collaboration with six stations, including Houston Public Media. Let's pick up our journey on the southern border. Jody Guerra owns an 80,000-acre cattle ranch outside Roma, Texas, a border town about an hour west of McAllen. The ranch has been in his family since the 1800s. His wife is an Episcopal preacher in Victoria, Texas. He invited the church volunteers to visit his ranch and learn what it means to live on the border. As we ride in his four-door Ford pickup, he tells us about a recent encounter with a group of men on his property.
These were individuals who didn't appear to be what one might consider a typical individual who's crossing through as a typical immigrant. These were individuals all clad in black, wearing large packs, you know. The leader of that pack had a weapon. The guy in the back had a weapon. So, you know, it seemed to be a pretty obvious drug operation at that point.
Jody and his father, Richard, take the church volunteers, Michael, Melissa, and Father Simone, to a set of bluffs in Roma that overlook the Rio Grande. As they approach, they can see the Mexican city of Miguel Alemán. People swim and play music at a park on the opposite riverbank. Richard Guerra walks with Father Simone on the bluffs.
It's amazing that here you are looking at another country, which it is. That's Mexico. This is the U.S.
Can they climb here?
Absolutely. Look how low the river is. They can walk across.
So anybody can come across.
That's the problem.
Many migrants end up here if they want to avoid detention centers or avoid the policy that only lets a certain number of migrants cross the border. The routes that smugglers use to get people across the border are the same ones cartels use to move drugs. According to CBP, this five-mile stretch of river leads the nation in what they call gotaways, people who cross illegally but don't get caught. Richard Guerra says Border Patrol is essentially powerless to control the flow of people and drugs and guns.
So consequently, the ideal thing for them would be to have a barrier, whatever you want to call it, plus a road that they can use to go back and forth. That's missing right now. They need that. And that is because this river is so low, those people that are swimming there, they can easily walk across here. Easily.
The Guerras say they support a border wall, mainly to prevent a pest called the fever tick from infecting their cattle. They've not raised cattle in 4 years because of the fever tick. The Guerras also make it clear that CBP agents are always welcome on their property. They even let CBP put a large white surveillance blimp on their property for free.
And it's got day and night capability.
Wow.
It's also got a radar detecting capability, but it could see way into Mexico.
CBP agent in charge Ricardo Moreno says the blimp can see about 25 miles into Mexico on a clear day. It's operated by former military contractors who tell us they surveilled Afghanistan with these blimps. Moreno explains to Father Simon why this so-called smart border technology could never replace a physical barrier.
You know, we have a drone capability right now, but because of the weather, as you can see from the flag, you know, really windy. You know, it's if they schedule 5 days out of the week, we may get only one flight just because of weather, technical issues. So, and that's throughout the nation.
Moreno says at the very least, you need a physical barrier to channel cartels and migrants away from cities and into the open desert where they're easier to capture. Back at the Guerras Ranch, Agent Moreno explains the challenges of policing the southern border right now.
People talk about caravans. You know, we average about 1,600 apprehensions here a day. That's our average. We go from as high as 2,500 apprehensions, and then like yesterday we had 1,300 apprehensions for a 24-hour period. We're about 150% over what we were last year. Unprecedented numbers. You know, 2014, which was declared a humanitarian crisis where we got FEMA funds, we've already surpassed those numbers right now. So our capacity at Rio Grande City Station, depending on square footage, number of toilets, number of sinks, is 119 people. 119 people at any given day. For example, today we've got 900 people detained there.
That's what I wanted to say.
You have 900 people
detained
in the space that was designed for 119.
And it's unfortunate. If you can imagine to feed 800 people three times a day, you know, the manpower that it takes, the funding that it takes. There's one station, which is the Wessico station, that has completely been shut down because they're handling all infectious diseases. A lot of cases of flu. We've got scabies. We've got lice issues, rashes. So that station, which still should be operating and patrolling, they're shut down. So what the cartel's doing is they're using those families as a way to get our attention. Because now we have to respond, we have to care, we have to give water, we have to do the humanitarian part. And then they're beating us with cocaine. We just had a seizure of heroin and then the marijuana.
During our conversation in late June, he told us that migrants are paying cartel-connected smugglers $400 or more to cross the border here. That's letting cartels buy more weapons and more drugs, empowering the very gangs that many of the migrants are trying to escape. Moreno also tells the volunteers that CBP plays a vital role in getting migrants to Sister Norma's respite center in McAllen, more than an hour away.
Without us facilitating that, how are they going to get to McAllen? You know, how 700 people that are being held in Roma going to get to McAllen? You know, there's no way. We've tried to release here, but there's only 3 or 4 seats in the buses that go out of Starr County that way.
On the ride home, Melissa says she still feels the same about helping migrants or building a border wall.
The idea of building a wall or a fence or any more enclosures to keep people out is just as unappealing to me now as it was the first time I came and the first time I thought about it.
Michael has not changed his mind either.
The experience of seeing the aero blimp and seeing the technology reinforces my idea that 21st century technology can be used instead of physical wall, that an old-fashioned method.
Father Simon is also steadfast. In fact, he plans to send Sister Norma more volunteers when he returns to Houston. Michael is organizing a clothing and food drive with the Episcopal churches and already has cargo trucks ready to be filled. Melissa says faith groups cannot remain neutral when families are suffering on the border.
if it offends politics, so be it. We're there to take care of our souls and to hear what's moral and right and good. And if politics is not in line, politics is the problem, not the church.
After we met Agent Moreno, ProPublica reported on a secret Facebook group for current and former Border Patrol agents. The group featured jokes about migrant deaths, obscene images of Latina lawmakers, and threats to members of Congress. CBP's leadership officially condemned the Facebook group. When we followed up with Agent Moreno for comment, his agency directed us to a written statement on CBP's website from Border Patrol Chief Carla Provost. It reads, quote, "These posts are completely inappropriate and contrary to the honor and integrity I see and expect from our agents day in and day out. Any employees found to have violated our standards of conduct will be held accountable," unquote. Let's dig a bit deeper into the disagreement over how faith communities should help migrants at the border or not. Joining us in studio is Elizabeth Dias, a national correspondent for The New York Times who covers faith and politics. Elizabeth, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
And Elisa Stebbing is Minister of Outreach and Youth Formation at Trinity Episcopal Church in the Woodlands, which is a suburb of Houston. Elisa, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
We also welcome your questions and comments and thoughts about what your faith community is doing or not doing with regards to the crisis at the border, how the conversation is going in your faith community, or maybe you're a faith leader, a minister, a pastor, a rabbi, an imam. How are you having this conversation with your congregants? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. Elisa Stebbing, I'd love to get your reaction to the story we just heard. Anything stand out to you?
Yes, it's a story that I'm familiar with, the struggle of people of faith and then their political persuasions on how to respond to the situation at the border. I think everyone's concern who lives and acts at the border, their concerns are valid. However, I feel that as people of faith, and I agree with Melissa and Michael and Father Simon, that our response as people of faith is to address the humanitarian conditions. We can disagree on policy, how immigration should be reformed, et cetera, but we cannot turn away from people who are suffering.
Elizabeth Dias, I'd love to get your sense of the religious landscape of voters in this country. One of our listeners, Rob, tweeted, "Religion is always an inherently political act." And we think a lot about the religious right. There is a religious left. Can you talk about the size and influence of these different religious voting blocks?
Sure. So we hear so much about the religious right, especially since President Trump was campaigning and then won the White House. And this rise of how white evangelicals have, by and large, just completely attached themselves to him and his agenda is really on the forefront when we think about what the thrust is of how, you know, religious blocks of voters are acting. And the religious left has been around. It's always been there, but the power and infrastructure and money that the religious right has built has just far outweighed those same structures on the left. And so when we think about something like immigration, and we hear all of these stories and that we just listened to in the past few minutes, it was notable to me that everyone we heard from was Catholic or Episcopal or Jewish, and we weren't hearing from groups of white evangelicals who were working at the border in these same kind of humanitarian ways.
Elisa, we understand that you've seen a divide forming in your church since the last presidential election, not entirely immigration related, but give us a sense of what that divide looks like.
Well, I think people are torn. It seems to evolve over time, and the concern and the conflict, internal conflict people are feeling is growing. I think that prior there was an affiliation to a political party that's conflicting both on the right and the left. And I'd like to come back to terminology if we have time. But I think that people are feeling fear. You know, they listen to fear-based rhetoric coming from political parties and from media and social media, and that grows within, and they feel we have to address, I want to be humanitarian, I want to respond to people suffering, I'm not a bad person, but we have reason to be very, very afraid. So I can't stand for this. I want a wall so I feel safer.
What was your thought on terminology?
So our rhetoric is part of the problem, because I'm seeing, I do see evangelicals as well as more progressive Christians and other faith-based communities down there. I also work very closely with some Baptist people that work with Sister Norma at the Humanitarian Respite Center. So to paint broad brush puts people in categories and in corners where they might come out of them if we weren't doing that so much. Terminology of people are illegal. People are not illegal. A human being is not illegal. People don't understand the terminology of what an asylum seeker is versus what a refugee is versus what an immigrant is. And so we use language that categorizes people and puts them in corners, and then they don't feel like they can come out of that box very easily.
Yeah, with regards to that terminology, that's why a lot of news organizations tend to use the term undocumented immigrants or illegal immigration if there is an act that breaks the law, but the person in their humanity is not illegal. The thing that they've done might be, and undocumented is just a more precise way to say it. Elisa, you said that the tone also changed last summer when these reports of migrant families being separated first broke. How have things changed since then?
I think they've gone up and down. I mean, there was last summer many, many faith groups, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, showed up in the at the border last July when the deaths and the separations of these families was first discovered, and there was just outrage, and there was a lot of unity in that. Not a lot was done. You know, people of faith really can't get close to the detention centers. There is not a lot we can do except call and address our senators and our representatives and you know, hound them for a response. But so it kind of, you know, there was a swell of outrage, and then it dies back down because people can't feel helpless. And then we see another picture like the man and his 23-month-old daughter in the river, and those images grab people's heart again. When we find out that the number of children in the detention centers is greater than we ever knew, and there are supposed policies saying we can't separate children anymore, but that never stopped. So people, the images grab people's heart, and there's a surge of, no, we can't do this anymore. But I'm seeing lately more people of faith, regardless of denomination, saying, wow, I just can't justify this in my soul anymore. I'm going to step out. I'm going to take a chance and take a very safe step forward, maybe contribute to the donation drive that we're doing, or maybe I can send some financial support to Sister Norma or some of the other respite care centers all along the border. And I'm seeing more of that starting to happen because this just isn't going away. But I do know people feel very, very helpless. And so if the surge doesn't cause any political changes or any changes in the policies in the detention centers, that tends to discourage people. And so we've got to keep up the pressure to get these centers more humane.
Elisabeth, I'd like to zoom out on this point to a more national perspective when we continue with Elisabeth Dias from the New York Times and Elisa Stebbing of Trinity Episcopal Church in the Woodlands, Texas. Pew Research finds that 68% of white evangelicals do not believe the U.S. has a responsibility to accept refugees. How does that translate politically, and what does that mean for everyday people in pews? Stay close. The Back now to our conversation with Elizabeth Dias of the New York Times and Elisa Stebbing of Trinity Episcopal Church near Houston. We got plenty of comments that we'd like to get to and also some voicemails from some of you on this issue. Here's a bit of what you left in our inbox.
This is Celeste. I'm a member of the First United Methodist Church of Germantown in Philadelphia. We are currently protecting two families in sanctuary. They are living in our church and have been with us since August. We feel this is part of our mission to do justice and love mercy, and we will continue to protect these precious people until their cases are reviewed and hopefully one day they can live in freedom here.
This is Phil from Michigan. I know liberals like to stand up and thump their chest and say, look at me, look how kind, caring, and compassionate I am for letting all these illegal aliens come into the country, and they're all going to have a better life. But they never tell you the cost. Illegal immigration decimates poorly educated Americans.
I'm starting to realize that silence is not the same as neutrality, and that in many cases it's responsible for me as a pastor to actually voice how the gospel lines up with the things facing our world today that may seem political. It's caused a lot of disruption in the circles of community that I walk in, but my wife and I both feel like it's an opportunity for us to stand up for what we believe and make a difference in a very tangible way.
Thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with us. We'll get to more of them in just a second, but Elizabeth, let's zoom out a little bit with regards to the way faith groups have dealt with this crisis. There was wide condemnation of the family separation policy at the border last year. What reaction have you seen to some of the newer immigration policies?
Well, even with the wide condemnation of the policy last year, the things that I heard in my reporting were, even though on the white evangelical conservative political side, leaders would condemn it, in the end, they stood behind the president and his policies. So it wasn't a consistent narrative, an ethic within how they lived their religious lives and how they were living their political lives. And so the big picture really, it's a cultural one. I mean, I keep finding people around the country are asking, you know, themselves, what's the Bible really about? What's it not about? What is politics about the Bible? And what is actual faith about it? And so now one of the most recent actions we saw last week with the administration issuing fines up to $500,000 for immigrants who were in sanctuary in churches, like the caller from Philadelphia just mentioned that they had people living in their church. And so in that case, we're seeing faith leaders and pastors and lawyers trying to come up with, you know, what do we do in this case? I mean, we've been dealing with the border crisis in this whole set of coordinated ways, but now we have immigrants waiting for their appeals cases, and they're being fined hundreds of thousands of dollars. So they're needing to come up with new strategies because they don't really know the administration's next step.
You reported last year about the divide that the immigration issue was causing among white evangelical women. Did this have a tangible effect in the midterms?
Yes and no. It's one of the parts of this whole development that I'm most fascinated about, because it's like Elisa was saying, the margins, like the edge, like where is the edge of where these communities like white evangelicals that we think of as a voting block, where is their change? Where is that starting to shift at all? And I see that most of the time with women. And I saw it in Texas with white evangelical women who had voted for President Trump. And then because of the family separations and because of this rhetoric that they were seeing in these actions that they just said was fundamentally not Christian, they were going to vote for for Beto O'Rourke, who ultimately didn't win. Senator Ted Cruz won his reelection. So do things like that make a tangible change in the politics? Maybe not in the outcome of that election, but the cultural conversation is changing.
I want to get more into the way that religious communities are discussing this through the faith, like what thus saith the Lord. And Elisa, I'd love to hear from you how you get into kind of the weeds of all this. Roy emailed, the beginning of Romans chapter 13 tells us how important it is to follow the laws of the governmental authorities, no matter who's in office. So break God's law to help, or watch, grind your teeth, and pray. Roy, you are correct, but incomplete. Romans 13 does indeed begin with, let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. I'm reading from the New International Version, by the way. However, Romans chapter 13, verse 8 says, let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Elisa Stebbing, I could see that turning into a really nasty Bible thumping fight.
Well, yes, it is in, you know, we're in mid-course on that Bible thumping fight right now. But you are right to continue on the verses there in chapter 13 of Romans. And throughout history, you can see how people can, on any issue, can use the Bible to further their cause or their stance on something. But you know, Jesus also stood up to authorities when it came down to human beings and to people and how they were being treated. It was the law to arrest and torture Jews in Germany. It was the law to do many things that we have done to each other around the world. So, yes, you can just cringe and grit your teeth and pray, but there are times when even Jesus demonstrated that, no, you've got to stand up for God's law first.
Go ahead.
How one does that needs to be tempered, right? I mean, you don't return violence with violence. But I do think it's this humanitarian issue that Elizabeth was talking about, where it gets down to individual people who say, I no longer can deal with the conflict I'm feeling with my faith beliefs, which is pretty much the core of a human being. I cannot stand that conflict in me anymore. And it is individuals that are stepping up and saying, can't do this anymore. I need to address the issue of separation of families, the issue of these children needing treatment and care. And whatever my political leanings are, this is baseline for me. I need to care for another human being.
With regards to that, Elizabeth, Jonathan tweeted, my multiracial church in Orlando hasn't addressed the border crisis at all. My perception is this is political, not wanting to upset conservative members. To me, social justice is a critical part of Christianity, and this miss is unsettling to the point I might leave the church.
I have been hearing people leaving their churches. It happens so slowly. It's so hard to see when it's not like we're seeing this mass exodus of people shifting. But it's true. I hear from mostly pastors when I ask white evangelical pastors about this, and they're peeling back the curtain a little bit about what they're facing. They'll talk about the challenges of donors. And it comes in tithing. I mean, what they're going to speak out on will have, you know, an effect on their own employment if they're
giving 10% of your income to the church.
Your income to the church. And so there's a concern. You know, if you've got a congregation that has mixed views, and maybe the conservative ones are donating more money, what do you do?
Elisa, with regards to the way that churches give in humanitarian ways, there was a report in 2017 by the Texas Interfaith Center that showed that faith groups gave nearly as much aid after Hurricane Harvey as the state did. The state of Texas provided $250 million, faith groups provided $216 million and $500,000 volunteer hours. It's interesting, and I wonder how you see this in your congregation, the difference between the way people feel about providing aid based on what they are aiding.
Absolutely. I'd agree with Elizabeth. You know, for Harvey and in Houston, that was a huge, we're still feeling the impacts of that. We're still having to rebuild from that. A natural disaster was something that was local, and our faith communities in the Houston area and in all of Texas responded very quickly and very immediately and gave a lot, gave of their time, gave of their efforts, and gave of their money. That's a neutral, there's some neutrality about that kind of issue than something like immigration, when there's, when you can think of people coming across the border as the other. Our bishops put out a statement yesterday of all six Episcopal dioceses in the state of Texas, and that these bishops cover the spectrum of conservative to more progressive political takes, but they all came together to decry this, to make a statement about the conditions on the borders. And I think that that is going to really help, because I have seen, as Elizabeth said, I have seen in our congregations people leaving because there's not a direct addressing of this situation that they're very upset about.
I'm glad you mentioned diocesan leadership, because Carol, Elizabeth Carol, wrote on Twitter, "Where are the U.S. Catholic bishops? Why aren't they calling for a national Catholic volunteer response to the humanitarian crisis? Why aren't they flooding Sister Norma with resources?" Have we heard from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops on this?
I get emails with their press releases, and they do often whenever there's like a new event at the border with family separations or with raids, these kinds of things. I'll see the statement, and it will we will talk about the church standing with immigrants and standing by neighbors. But it is different from how they handle the issue of abortion, where there is, you know, lobbying behind the scenes in Washington of and more direct. The leaders are being very vocal about much more what kind of policy they want to see. And so it's a tension right now within the Catholic Church. I think there's a lot of attention about what's happening with white evangelicals, but it's a tension with white Catholics, many of whom are conservative.
I was just going to ask you about white evangelicals, mm-hmm. because there seems to be a split that's growing. I mean, a few weeks ago, there was,
yes.
Russell Moore, who's this prominent Southern Baptist, who criticized President Trump's immigration policy. That drew some public criticism from Jerry Falwell Jr., who is the president of Liberty University, which is a Christian university in Virginia, founded by his father, the late Jerry Falwell. I wonder if it's getting harder for evangelicals to defend President Trump, and if this creates an opening for some Democrats in 2020.
It might. Democrats are starting to think about that. The spat that you're mentioning between Russell Moore and Jerry Falwell was so notable because, you know, the division between those two men and the constituencies they represent, there has been happening since President Trump started his campaign. And what happened was that in the end, white evangelicals as a political bloc were much more in line with Jerry Falwell. There were more of them. And the Russell Moore contingent was more like what we've seen of the white evangelicals in the past, of the George W. Bush era.
We should also note that some of the Democratic hopefuls are working to win over these religious voters. Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand, Pete Buttigieg, they've all made plays for religious voters. Elizabeth Warren called the 2020 election a righteous fight. Pete Buttigieg was on The View back in March. Here's part of what he said.
And I do think there are the stirrings out there in our country right now of a religious left that understands that living your faith might also have to do with paying more attention to those most in need.
That's right.
And not celebrating those who already have the most wealth and the most power.
Can we talk about...
Sorry to interrupt you.
That was South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg speaking on The View back in March. Elisa, our time is short, but I want to get to one more question from a listener. Danielle asked, "I'd like to hear the minister talk more about how she deals with the divisions within her congregation. How does she keep the peace?" Elisa?
I keep the peace, and it's been some hard work. I mean, I've had to make very intentional efforts to meet with people and talk with them. But I find that when you get with someone one-on-one, you know, I have these coffee conversations with people, you find there are so many similarities that it is easier to talk and discuss this when you know a face, a name. And I think the work for people of faith in their churches, although it's a lot more time-consuming, a lot more will not be a fast fix, is to be in relationship with each other, to talk, to find out what you have in common. And you find out that the concern and care is there. When you take down the barriers between each other and quit politicizing, well, I can't talk to you because you're a Republican, I can't talk to you because you're a Democrat. We have to knock that down and see each other ourselves as human beings before we can have a humanitarian response at the border. We have to be humanitarian to each other. And that does take very, very intentional work. It's discouraging work. It's hard work, but it's necessary.
Alisa Stebbing, an Episcopal minister from the Woodlands near Houston, the Minister of Outreach and Youth Formation at Trinity Episcopal Church. Alisa, thanks for talking to us.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
And Elizabeth Dias, national correspondent for the New York Times, covering faith and politics. Elizabeth, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
This conversation was produced by James Morrison in collaboration with our partner station, Houston Public Media. Special thanks to its reporter, Elizabeth Trovall. 1A Across America is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Please do keep the conversation going on our Facebook page and on Twitter. You can also check out pictures of our trip to the border on Twitter at 1A. And online at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.